As you know, we have the zechut, the privilege of having a wonderful guest speaker who's going to address us in just a few minutes when we conclude the service about the situation in Iran. And so I'm going to just say a word about this very rich parsha. And in fact, really, I'm just going to offer a theory about one thing that happens in the parsha. Because, as you may know, the Et Hanan not only contains the Shema, it also has a second set of what? The Ten Commandments. Now, you would think that one iteration of the Ten Commandments would be enough. And the question is, why do you need to repeat the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments? So here is a theory based on recent experience in my life, and sadly, I know in some of yours as well. It's been a few months now since my father passed away, and I have seen something happen among myself and my brothers that I suppose I could have anticipated, but I didn't know, which is when we speak to each other, we often use those cliches that my father used over and over again. So one of us will say, "You made your point, now drop it." My father used to say that to us all the time when we would say, "Can I have this? Can I have this? Can I have this?" He would say, "You made your point, now drop it." Now, he said this thousands of times in my childhood because, like most children, we would say the same thing over and over again. But the thing that he repeated over and over becomes actually, later on, a sort of mantra. And it doesn't stop, it echoes in our minds. And it seems to me that the Torah does the same thing. That is, when God has an important message, saying it once is insufficient. Because if you say something once, you know, there's a German phrase, einmal ist keinmal, once is nothing. If you say something once, nobody hears it. You have to say it over and over and over again till it wears sort of deep grooves into your mind and into your soul, and then you hear it. And that's especially true after something difficult makes it seem like everything should change. So after the catastrophe of the spies in the Torah, you would think that God would have an entirely new message because the first message didn't work. But actually, repeating the Ten Commandments with slight variations reminds us that the message is the same and it's important, it's just that you haven't integrated it yet. And so after Tisha B'Av, after the destruction of the temple, we have the Ten Commandments over again, which reminds us that yes, it's true, terrible things happened, but not because the message wasn't a powerful message, wasn't an important message, wasn't in fact the appropriate message, but only because it hadn't yet been absorbed and integrated into your life. And so I think Moshe repeats the Ten Commandments because he knows he's not going to be there anymore to say to the Israelites, "Don't you remember what I said to you?" And so he repeats himself because he knows that if you repeat yourself often enough, then the echo continues on even when you are not there anymore. And that is a beautiful and a powerful thing. And one more lesson from Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses our teacher. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you very much, Rabbi, and thank you for having me. I'm very happy that I'm here with my wife, Janice, and somewhere out there is a member of Sinai Temple who does great work for me, Esther Azal. And I don't know where she is at this moment, but she's right here. Okay. I have a longstanding familiarity with Sinai Temple from the days actually of Rabbi Chodas's tenure. I used to hang out here with my friends from my years as a camper, a dishwasher, and an infirmary assistant at Camp Ramah. And Rabbi Chodas, I don't know if anybody remembers those days, but that was 55 years ago. If you don't believe me, I'll try to find you a certified copy of my birth certificate. I'm also very honored to be here because I do have tremendous respect and admiration for Rabbi Wolpe's leadership and his intellect, and I have many friends who are members and lay leaders of the congregation. And I have to say particularly, I think a lot of us in Washington are particularly impressed by the enormous percentage of the membership of Sinai that has committed to pro-Israel political activism. It's evidenced only in part by the huge attendance at and growing attendance at each year's AIPAC annual policy conference in Washington. So what I'd like to do is make a few points as someone who spends a lot of his working hours on the Middle East, and particularly on the U.S.-Israel relationship and on Iran and the threats and opportunities for Israel and the United States in that region, but leave as much time as I can for questions from you and comments and try to turn this into a bit of a dialogue. I think the first thing to do is we should start by getting all our cards on the table. My guess is that many of you are nervous, anxious, and perhaps in some cases deeply frightened by the pronouncements and the policies of the Obama administration. There is no doubt that the administration is taking some risks, and there is, whenever one takes risks, there is cause for concern. I share that concern, but I believe some of the anxiety comes because of a unfounded but sincere fear that its policies reflect a fundamental change in the special relationship that U.S. has had with Israel for a very long time. And that this fundamental change comes because of either hostility to Israel or tremendous naivete. I'd like to state my own personal belief quite emphatically that this administration, it is not naive. It is not captured by a far-left mindset that blames either America or Israel for the ills of the world or the Middle East. This administration fully embraces, and I wouldn't say it if I didn't believe it, fully embraces the special relationship between our two countries. It has made mistakes, but it's also demonstrated it has a capacity to learn quickly from its mistakes. Let's start with Iran, because to me that is an issue to some extent of transcendent importance. Start out, except for, and I'd be happy to elaborate and make the case, but let me just come to the conclusion quickly. The policies up till now with respect to Iran, and most importantly, stopping Iran's nuclear weapons program, have not been working. This administration came in at a period of time when we were trying isolation and containment, and the nuclear enrichment of Iran continued every day. Their centrifuges grew in number, they grew in sophistication, the amount of low-enriched uranium continued to grow and grow to the point where it is almost at the place where you could reprocess it into highly enriched uranium and have enough uranium, weapons-grade uranium, for one nuclear weapon. The administration enters engagement, I believe, as a tactic. We all can hope that that process works to the goal of stopping Iran's nuclear weapons program, but no one should be foolish enough to think that the odds are high that that will be the case. But if you believe, as I do, that the only thing short of the military option that can change the Iranian regime's decision to have a nuclear weapons program is a level of crippling sanctions engaged in not by the United States alone, The United States has had sanctions, and complete and practically comprehensive sanctions on Iran since 1979. But the international community, if you believe that it is only through that kind of crippling sanctions that one can create enough pressure from the people of Iran on the regime to change its course, and if you believe, as I do, that the engagement period is a precondition to getting the international community to enter into those kinds of crippling sanctions, the engagement makes sense. In other words, I don't think the engagement will produce the kind of quick diplomatic solution to this problem, nor do I think, I hope otherwise, nor do I think that we'll quickly see a suspension of Iran's nuclear enrichment program. But I do believe that this engagement period is a precondition, is a necessary, perhaps not a sufficient, but definitely a necessary precondition to having those kinds of international sanctions developed and put into place. In the backdrop of this strategy, we have the amazing events of recent months leading up to and since the election in Iran. There's no doubt that this regime will never be the same. The fundamental doctrine that was introduced by Ayatollah Khomeini of Walayat Faqih, the supremacy of the jurisprudential, or essentially the notion that the supreme leader received his commands from Allah and that therefore whatever he said was the final word on this subject, has been seriously eroded. You see it in many different ways. You see it in the streets. You see it in the strong level of clerical opposition. You see it in the willingness of the president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, to ignore even the orders from the hardline clerics, and particularly the supreme leader. So that regime is undergoing to go a fundamental change. How it turns out, none of us know. We all hope. We all stand with the people of Iran and what they're trying to achieve. But we have to also, at the same time, keep our eyes on why this is such a transcendent issue, and it is because of that nuclear weapons program. And I'm not going to take the time here, it might come out through questions, to repeat all the arguments for why that is the big picture. That is what we should be keeping our eye on, that particular ball, that has to remain the focus of our diplomatic and strategic pressures. A great deal of activity that is not that focused on by the media is going on to lay the foundation for those kinds of international sanctions. In the summit in Moscow, not much reported, no particular major advances announced, but more time was spent between President Medvedev and President Obama on the issue of Iran, the threat, and the way to deal with that threat than any other single issue at the summit. Numerous conversations are going on with the Europeans. Let me read you one paragraph to sort of confirm my assertion that there is a larger strategic objective in what we're going through now. I'm reading from Haaretz, yesterday's paper, and the reason, not that newspapers get it right, but that this was sent to me by the Israeli embassy. They think this accurately reflects what has happened. As you know, in the past week, the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, the Chairman of the National Security Council, General James Jones, Dennis Ross, the Special Advisor on Iran and Middle East issues in the National Security to the President, someone who I think is familiar to a lot of the people here, and Senator George Mitchell have all been in Israel. Quite an unusual situation. The report sent to me by the embassy from Israel yesterday morning that came out in Haaretz yesterday says, and I quote, "American officials briefed Israel this week on the administration's ideas for intensifying sanctions against Iran if it fails to respond to President Barack Obama's offer of dialogue. U.S. National Security Advisor James Jones, who is now in Israel to discuss Iran's nuclear program, indicated Tehran has until the UN General Assembly in the last week of September to respond. This is a time-limited engagement, I add parenthetically. U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates delivered a similar message during his visit here earlier this week. If no satisfactory answer is received, the Americans said, they would work to form an international coalition to impose harsh sanctions on Iran. A senior source in Jerusalem, that means an Israeli, said the American message to Israel in these talks was to lower its profile, refrain for a time from ranting and raving. Sometimes it's good for all of us to try and refrain. It's very hard to get Congress not to rant and rave, but there's in public about Iran until the international evaluation on Iran takes place at the end of September. Until that time, we must give diplomacy a chance, the official said. New sanctions would mainly aim to significantly curb Tehran's ability to import refined petroleum products. Despite its huge crude oil reserves, Iran has only limited refining capacity, so it imports large quantities of refined products such as gasoline. And then the article makes reference to the legislation that Senator Lieberman in the Senate and I in the House are sponsoring, and goes on to talk about other strategies. But my point in reading this was simply to say a form of independent corroboration. This is, again, not some mushy-headed effort to hope for the best without thinking of what of consequences. This is part of a coherent strategy. It may not work, but it has a logic to it, and it should be given a chance to play itself out. And I would urge for you to consider all of that. Has the United States made mistakes on this issue? I think so. I think the effort months ago to highly, visibly, and publicly pressure Israel regarding the military option was a mistake, not because the military option provides some wonderful answer, but because it's important for Iran to think that the military option is available, whether from us or from Israel. So, but you've noticed that that hasn't been repeated lately. Let me turn for now to Israel and again go through some reactions I have to some things that are happening now. First of all, contrary to a lot of reports and a lot of concerns, I am absolutely convinced that the Obama administration is not trying to destabilize or undermine Netanyahu. That is not their goal in this process that's taking place now. That is not the president's goal. That is not Senator Mitchell's goal. To the contrary, I believe there's recognition in the White House that Prime Minister Netanyahu is the person who can most effectively cut the deal when the deal is ready to be cut. That because of his political background within Israel, because of his traditional positions, because he has a sensible approach to moving forward, which is a ground-up approach, and at the same time a willingness to meet with the Palestinian leadership to keep a dialogue going at the top, and because he has recognized what had become a huge symbolic question, that at the end of the day, the goal here is two peoples living in two states side by side in peace and security. This was always blown up to be more than an issue than it really was. I remember talking with the Prime Minister when he wasn't even yet a candidate. There were no elections at that point. And we had a discussion about the Palestinian state. And he says, it's a metaphysical issue. Can it be a state if it doesn't have a military? Can it be a state if it doesn't control its own airspace? And I would say, well, it could be a state without a military and without control of its own airspace. It's how you label it, but in any event, he has spoken clearly on the subject. And now, of course,
the Palestinian Authority is refusing to go into those negotiations and has made comments which indicate they want to sit back and just hope that the administration keeps putting on pressure for Israel to make concession after concession. I don't believe that's in the administration's agenda. I also believe here the administration has made a couple of mistakes on the issue of settlements. It's enunciated an absolutist position, which I think they no longer hold, but it was a mistake to enunciate in the first place. And I, my belief, my hope certainly, and my belief generally is that within a few weeks, you will see an arrangement that deals with a that sets to put back trust in the relationship on this issue, and I won't go into all the reasons why that trust hasn't existed, but we'll get that issue off the table. And now let's think a little bit about what the rest of the administration and the Mitchell agenda is. He wants to turn around the dynamic put forth in the Arab Peace Initiative, which says Israel concedes on every single issue, and when it concedes on all issues and gives what the initiative calls for, then the Arabs will start making moves to make those to bring about the kind of peace that they claim they will do. Mitchell wants to reverse that, and not he wants to change the sequence. The notion that the Arabs' governments sit back and wait until Israel's made every concession and then come forward with movements on recognition and peace is not acceptable to this administration. Moreover, the issue isn't even Israel making a deal on settlements so that we can then go to the Arabs to make other moves. It is Mitchell's intention to have a simultaneity of concessions and moves by the Palestinian Authority, and very much needed on the issues of incitement and fighting terror, by the Arab governments on the issue of steps to move towards a state of recognition of the permanence of the state of Israel, and that those be announced together. We don't hear much attention on that side, and we see a lot of conclusions regarding rejection by the Arab governments of any efforts in that regard. I think you should sit back before you quickly make a judgment and give Mitchell a little credit for being a shrewder negotiator than those media reports would give him credit for. Has the administration made mistakes in this area? Again, I've mentioned a couple that there's no doubt about it, but by and large, I think they've seen a huge mistake was not speaking to the Israeli people. This administration believes in that special relationship. It was a mistake in his speech in Cairo to make the case for Israel's existence based on discrimination, pogroms, and finally the Holocaust, rather than on the larger historical and religious perspective. Why was it a mistake? Not because I expect the President of the United States to give the Muslim world a lecture on the roots of Zionism, but because it fed into the Arab narrative, which says, if these are the reasons for Israel, then why shouldn't it exist in Europe? Why does it have to exist in our area? That was a mistake. It was a mistake not to talk to the Israeli people clearly and often about the feelings about Israel, but I think the administration will correct that at the appropriate time in the very near future. So, by and large, I understand very much the sources of concern and anxiety. I think in some cases they are more overwrought than they should be. I'm myself am nervous because when I see a change in traditional positions, I wonder where it's going and how it will end up, and with risks are a form of gambles, and sometimes gambles come back to hit you in the face. But I'm persuaded by the intentions, the goals, and the sense of strategy in what this administration is trying to do. And I would urge those who share my feelings about Israel, about the U.S.-Israel relationship, about the goals that we have in that area. And to remember one thing, on all this talk about settlements and all this things about what's left out of a particular speech, on the fundamental security questions, the military relationship, hanging tough on Hamas until they have accepted the conditions that the international community has set out, renouncing terrorism, recognizing Israel's right to exist, acknowledging the viability of all agreements. This administration has not wavered for a second. Their goals on Iran are not to live with a nuclear Iran, but to stop Iran from having a nuclear weapon. Their goal with Israel is not to try and leverage critical security issues in order to get Israeli concessions. And with that, I think I ought to stop. And thank you very much for giving me a chance just to share some of these thoughts with you and hear from you.
You're welcome to come in and have a seat. We have a few minutes for questions before we conclude the service this morning. So if you have questions, yes, please, and I'll repeat it. Go ahead. With regard to the sanctions, has anything changed in terms of Russia and China's relationship to Iran?
There's been no formal change. A foundation for change, particularly with Russia, has been laid. The nature of the U.S.-Russia relationship deteriorated dramatically in recent years. This administration has tried to change the direction of that relationship. The things I know from personally, having been in Moscow twice in the last 8 months, focused primarily on this issue, is Russia does not want Iran to have nuclear weapons, and Russia is more concerned than ever about Iran's military program. And Russia has agreed, at least for the time being, not to sell the kinds of air defense systems to Iran, even though they're under contract to sell them, that would make any military option much less effective if Iran got those systems, and that's particularly the S-300. China, of course, has these huge energy deals with Iran, but they pale in comparison with Iran's energy deals with Saudi Arabia. So one part of putting together this coalition on international sanctions involves the Saudis doing something which they don't always like to do, which is to demonstrating a leadership in terms of their dealing with China that Iran with a nuclear weapon capability is unacceptable to the Saudis, and that Saudi Arabia's relationship with China is very much affected by how they approach Iran. We're laying a foundation for a reassessment and hopefully the start of those sanctions in late September. China usually follows Russia on these issues. We're spending a great deal of effort to try and change Russia's calculations about this.
Okay. Go ahead. The question was about a report about renewed hostilities between Israel and Hezbollah on the Lebanon border, and how does that factor into calculations with Iran?
And the reference was based on a report from the Stratfor Group, which is a very interesting analytical firm, although I do remember that 2 weeks after the Iranian elections, they concluded that these protests would go nowhere, that the Ahmadinejad forces were much stronger than the opposition. So they've been wrong, too. Look, there was a major evidence in the explosion of an arms cache in southern Lebanon, clearly a Hezbollah arms cache which violated the Security Council resolutions for which the UN peacekeeping force did not confront them in the way they should have, and for which a lot of Hezbollah activists prevented any investigation from it. Unless it is a decision designed in Tehran to take the pressure off what's going on there, I'm skeptical that that's in Hezbollah's interest. Hezbollah is trying to, first of all, they were pursuing the election strategy. Fortunately, they lost in the election, but they are trying to work through a return of the veto power with the new Lebanese government. So I think for them at this particular moment, it wouldn't make sense to start a major new confrontation with Israel on its border, given their political objectives inside Lebanon. But I certainly, I've been fooled before.
We're back here. Go ahead.
Mr. Congressman, thank you for coming to our congregation. We're grateful to have you this
morning. Please, go ahead.
I wanted to ask about your comments about a potential Palestinian state being, quote unquote, demilitarized. And to ask, and as a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, are there any analogs you can share with us for other nation states, sovereign nation states that are, quote unquote, demilitarized?
Yes, I was at
Let me just repeat the question so everyone hears. Are there any analogies, are there any analogs for a demilitarized state?
Yes, I went with then Speaker of the House Jim Wright in 1988 to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Costa Rica's decision not to have a military. But much of what's going on here is sui generis, and the fact is, the guiding assumption from the time of the Oslo Accords, where you first started seeing an Israeli acceptance of two states that once Israel's security went enhanced, was always the assumption that the Palestinian state would be demilitarized and that with a verifiable and enforceable procedure to ensure that. So, there are not many countries where that is so, Costa Rica being the example that first comes to mind. But by the way, Costa Rica, alone among Central American countries, has been the most peaceful country, the least threatened country in that region. But without regard to those precedents, that is a critical condition of any recognition of a Palestinian state.
Because we don't like to favor the left or the right, we're all the way over here now. So, Dr. Green?
What is your best estimate as to how much time we have before Iran has the nuclear capability for a bomb?
What's the best estimate for how long we have before Iran has a nuclear capability?
First of all, how you have to define Iran with a nuclear capability. In some ways, that line has already been crossed. They clearly have developed an ability to enrich uranium and reprocess uranium. I guess the line that I would draw is line where if that day Iran kicked out the IAEA inspectors, turned off the cameras, were they at the point where they could take the uranium they have already enriched to a low grade, and would they be in the position where they could reprocess it into a weapons-grade uranium, develop the clear design they have for warheads, miniaturize them enough to go on the missiles that they've already developed? And I think a year to 2 years is the line that would give them that capability.
Go ahead.
Why is this administration so naive to think a strong government of Israelis and having supposedly peace between the Palestinians and Israelis, that will resolve all the problems with the Islam world?
Okay, the question was, I'm going to rephrase it to be less incendiary, but the question is, does the administration believe that if there's peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis, that will solve all the problems in the Islamic world?
Well, that's interesting you asked that question, because that was the question I asked candidate Obama before I decided to support him. And he clearly doesn't believe that any more than dealing with Iran's nuclear weapon would take care of all the issues involving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. there are clearly ripple impacts and relationships on all these different issues. But the notion that what fundamentally has taken that part of the world and put it where it is the result of the existence of Israel and the conflict with Israel is nonsense, and I think this administration understands that. I don't think they are, as you said, so naive as to believe that.
Have you had the opportunity to read, I notice a couple of people holding it, and I've only glanced at it, haven't read it yet, Elliot Abrams' piece in the Wall Street Journal?
I have not. I actually brought it out with me. I haven't read it, but I have heard about it.
Okay.
Well, he's done several things in the Wall Street Journal. This is not the one about his understandings with the Israeli government regarding settlements. This is...
No.
No, then I haven't.
Okay. Doctor? Okay, so the two questions were, did you hear anything about $20 million that the Obama administration gave to Palestinians in Gaza to resettle in the U.S., and what do you have to say about the $900 million that was given by the Obama administration to Palestinians in Gaza?
The administration has provided, with Israeli cooperation, a significant amount of humanitarian assistance to the people of Gaza, and of course, the $900 million figure I think is quite high, and we don't want to mix up the assistance that the United States government has given the Palestinian Authority and Salim Fayyad with money going to Hamas. The only money I've heard about for refugee resettlement is some money for Palestinians in Iraq to come to the United States. I'm unaware of a program to provide $20 million for Palestinians in Gaza to come here.
Go ahead.
But I'll check it out.
Several days ago, the Secretary of State on an Asian tour went public with a contingency planning of providing a nuclear shield in the event that Iran should obtain a nuclear bomb. My question to you is, by going public at this time, which I believe was untimely, did we by implication create the impression that the United States is reconciled to the possession of Iran of a nuclear bomb?
The question was, during her Asian tour, the Secretary of State said something about the United States providing a nuclear shield for Israel in the event of Iran getting a nuclear weapon. Was it unwise for her to do so because it seemed to concede that Iran would in fact get a nuclear weapon? I just want to say as an aside to that, but she did say on Meet the Press the exact opposite.
Right. And I talked to her right after that, because when I read that report, I had the exact same concern you were. We should not be talking about what will happen after Iran has a nuclear weapon. What she was doing, not so artfully the first time, much more effectively on Meet the Press, was trying to tell the Iranians, whatever you think you're going to get from pursuing a nuclear weapon, you are not going to get. You are not going to be a stronger regional power in the Middle East, because we are going to be out there much more assertively. She was trying to speak to their motivation, not our policy. But I had the same reaction you did when I first heard it. I think on Meet the Press that became clear.
Let me ask a final question, and then I hope if you have a few moments, maybe people can ask you after we conclude
sure.
The service. And that is this: clearly you hear there's a degree of unease. What would you recommend to the Jewish community that their public position be, and what would you recommend that we do to most effectively advocate for Israel in this political climate?
One, I think it's appropriate to give expression to your unease. Because, again, I think the unease is misplaced, but I'm not sure. And expressing that unease helps to ensure that people in power are reminded of the great concern and are careful and thoughtful about how they're moving ahead. What I wouldn't do is I don't think there is a basis for hysterical reactions to what's happening. I think there's a strategy here. So I'd express the unease, but I'd, and it's a good place to say it, have a little faith here. There, people like Dennis Ross, I mean, I've known him since he was a graduate student at UCLA in the early 1970s. There are tough-minded, deeply committed friends of Israel in this administration in major roles of authority. And I'd also ask you to think in the context of, it isn't like things were progressing so wonderfully before this administration came in. So leaving a little room for them to maneuver for a short time, watching for the potential negative consequences, but open to the positive potentials, I think is good personal advice for being able to sleep at night. But stay active, keep coming to those policy conferences, write us. Don't be timid about voicing the concerns. I would just keep it. I just try and keep the notion of a strategy here in mind in terms of what the administration is doing.